Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the pending shutdown of the US government following the latest move by the Republican House to load conditions on keeping the government funded through a continuing resolution the Senate will not even begin to consider until Monday afternoon, 10 hours before the shutdown. Steve Clemens, the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live, joins us to discuss the latest showdown in the Tea Party's governance by extortion. Then we will speak with the founder and editor of Somalia Report, against whom the so-called White Widow the Kenyan authorities have implicated in the Maul massacre, Samantha Lewthwaite, issued a fatwa before her Twitter went silent on September the 20th. Robert Young-Pelton joins us to clarify the confusion over the 61 people still missing from the Maul attack and the 11 al-Shabaab terrorists the Kenyans claim to have in custody, as well as analyzing the fighting and factions within the failed state of Somalia. Then finally, we will speak with the former Iran specialist on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan, Gary Sick, who met with the Iranian President Hassan Rouhani last Wednesday. He joins us to discuss his meeting, the P5 plus one meeting that followed, the phone call between the two presidents after 34 years of hostility, and the meeting at the IAEA last Friday on the possibility of opening up Iran's nuclear sites that is a precondition for removing the crippling sanctions Rouhani wants ended. And joining us now is Steve Clemens, who's the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation. And previously, Steve Clemens served as executive director of the Japan-American Society of Southern California and co-founded with Charmans Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Clemens.
My pleasure, Ian.
And as I mentioned in the opening, Steve, the Tea Party's governance by extortion seems to be continuing. We're heading for a showdown. The House loaded conditions on the continuing resolution, which has now gone back to the Senate, but the Senate's not even going to consider it until sometime Monday afternoon, which is about 10 hours before the shutdown. So what's it look like to you?
Well, I think it looks like unbelievable immaturity, which is convincing Americans, you know, what they've largely suspected is that their government is dysfunctional, paralyzed, not able to be mature, and it's kind of like, you know, being with, you know, really really crazy people in a car where one of the crazy people's at the driver thing and you know, and saying, hey, this ride over the cliff is going to be a lot of fun. You've got Tea Party Tea Party members of the House out talking to their districts, out tweeting, out sending notes and appearing in the media that they are thrilled that they're going into this crisis, and they say this is what the country needs. And it is it's an extraordinary moment, and it'll be one of those moments, I think, because I don't see anything stopping them right now, that'll go down in American history as one of the, you know, we've had other moments in American history where legislators did horribly, you know, idiotic things, and this will be one of those, and so it'll be one for the history books.
So there's Harry Reid described this as Tea Party anarchy. There have also been reports from from Capitol Hill reporters that these hordes of Republican congressmen in and out of the chamber, there's a wafting smell of liquor. Have you heard those reports?
I have not. That's shocking. If it's true, I mean, if that is true, then this is all much worse than we.
Well, doesn't it feel a bit like a fraternity row kind of exercise? And
they've been behaving as if it's a reckless fraternity night, and you know, unfortunately, we're all going to be paying the price for the hangover, and I think the country, its solvency in the world is really being threatened by what's happening today. Our ability to kind of sit and talk to other countries about democracy is being undermined today enormously. I mean, this is mob. This is the mob side of politics. And, you know, a lot of people said, how did it get this way? And, you know, there's structural reasons. And I go back, you know, and you and I talked about it ages ago of, you know, what Tom DeLay had really engineered in this country, in this kind of, both parties engaged in it, but no one liked Tom DeLay in terms of the extreme redistricting of lines, so that the notion that you would have reasonable, pragmatic moderates in either party able to win these, that what you ended up having is essentially districts that were appealing to more and more populist extremes. And I think combined, I'm going to just say it for what it is, there is a deep racism that's also part of this. People that just hate Barack Obama on every front, that they don't want to negotiate, compromise, win some and lose some in a process of demonstrating that is how democracy works. Their hate of him is so profound that it's driven many of these people and their voters — it's not just the members, it's their voters — to these extreme positions. And the redistricting makes it very difficult to find ways to dislodge them. And so we may have this problem for a long time.
Well, Steve Clemens, you mentioned the full faith and credit of the U.S. being in jeopardy. That's the second bite of the apple that the Republican House and the Tea Party caucus have in mid-October, isn't it? I mean, we're dealing with the first bite of the apple to get rid of Obamacare, and now they're apparently offering in this CR that they went back loaded with conditions, one of which is to get rid of the tax on medical devices. The other one is to delay Obamacare for a year. Then they've already told us that come mid-October, they're going to try all this over again. In fact, the wish list that they have for mid-October, which is, again, government by extortion, is extraordinary. It's every bill that the House sent to the Senate that wasn't passed.
It is government by extortion, and it is, it's a sad moment in our history. I remember, I think it was about a year and a half, 2 years ago, when we were at the, we were in the debt ceiling battles before, and you ended up having a modest decrease by the rating agencies of America's credit rating abroad, in part because of, one, their concern about the deficit, but also in part because of the dysfunction within the Congress. And so these sorts of antics were already there. What I was, anyone watching at that time, I was a bit disappointed in the White House, because you saw the Republicans grab onto this debt ceiling debate, which, you have to understand, most Americans knew nothing about. They were largely ignorant that this dynamic was in play and didn't understand that the funding of the government, your funding obligations that the Congress has passed in the past. So these are obligations that the nation has that aren't new ones, this is stuff that these same legislators allowed to go and become law in past years. The White House really never rolled out a campaign to explain the stakes to the country. And I sort of saw the Republicans hijack an issue, dominate it, they continue to dominate it, and the messaging that would kind of inform Americans more broadly of another option has really never really taken hold. So it is an extortion racket for a small number of people who are potentially wrecking the country. And I hope the country wakes up and roars back because at them and demonstrates in their district. I've been shocked and alarmed at how little focus there is on each one of these individuals and trying to find ways to really reduce and restrict their options for the rest of their lives for what they're doing to the country.
Again, I'm speaking with Steve Clemens, who's the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation, and previously he served as executive director of the Japan-America Society of Southern California and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. But the president said some time back that the only, the holy grail, the only unifying principle amongst Republicans is to deny 40 million Americans health care. And they have, keep talking about it in these apocalyptic terms, which has no connection to reality. It's extraordinary hyperbole, but there's not a lot coming back from the White House to balance the misinformation about Obamacare. I'm astounded that the White House and the Democrats haven't been more assertive in pointing out the obvious, which is that the Republicans, what they're really afraid of is this thing may work, and they are just pulling out all the stops to stop it. And I believe Obama's finally sort of got the message the other day where he made the point, if this thing is so bad, why don't you guys let it go ahead and get voted into law, and then it'll be the train wreck that you say it will be, and then you'll all be heroes, and you'll get elected in 2014 and 2016.
Yeah, there's tape, though, of Senator Ted Cruz of Texas and Rush Limbaugh making exactly that point, where you know, Cruz and Limbaugh are saying, oh, these people will get on, they'll like it so much they won't get off. And so they are saying quite publicly that they know that this will be popular, and then it will be harder and harder to kill it. You have people like John McCain who have been very forceful in their criticism of this strategy and among some other Republican senators. So the Republican Party is divided. And, you know, one would think the Democrats are on their side. I just find it amazing that given the division within Republican ranks, given the power of the Democratic Party, that the White House somehow hasn't engineered a way to break the back of this resistance. And that's what's politically confusing, because we know that not all Republicans are on board with this. And you know, it would seem, but there's a fear out there. I don't know what. It's kind of like a, you know, a kind of fascism on the right or something, that they are afraid of breaking ranks. And so one wonders why is leadership not finding a way to seduce reasonable Republicans? John McCain is behaving very responsibly on this. Why not use that element as a wedge to go after this and garner those votes in a different way? And to, I mean, that may be the end of John Boehner's leadership, but not all of those House members are on board with this.
Right, but Boehner seems to be intimidated by the Tea Party to the point where he won't allow a straight-up and down vote, which would carry the day because of the Democrats would join with a few sensible Republicans.
Failure of leadership on his part.
Right.
And so we're watching a train wreck. We're all being able to foresee and foretell a train wreck. And on the issues of defunding something as profoundly significant as Obamacare, which is kicking in, and despite pretty reasonable positions of the White House, because they know that, you know, they've delayed, you know, certain elements of the implementation of the program to accommodate some of the concerns on the right, that every time the White House gives an inch, the Tea Party sees it as a concession and weakness that animates them further to drive and harder for more. And I think the White House has just got to stop playing nice guy in this.
But what I find extraordinary, Steve Clements, is the contempt that so many of the Republicans and the Tea Party people have for average working Americans and the cavalier attitude that they have about shutting the government down. You keep hearing that the first casualties, and it looks as if this will start on Tuesday, the first casualties will be 800,000 non-essential government employees. Well, since when are the people working for the government non-essential?
They are essential. Every one of them is essential, and they have families. They have children in school. They have bills they have to pay. I have a situation where one of the workers for government happens to, you know, rent an apartment of mine, and this person called and said, you know, I'm going to be one of these people that's laid off. I'm going to have problems with. You know, my rent. And I said, you know, I fully understand that. I fully understand I'm on your side because I understand what's going on. It's not your fault, and we'll work something out. So there are people out there with real lives. These are not the wealthy aristocrats, you know, that Ted Cruz keeps painting out. These are normal, average, middle class and lower middle class people working in the government who, you know, have things, and they're going to be laid off en masse. It's going to be devastating.
So, Steve Clements, in the last few minutes, let's turn from domestic dysfunction to foreign policy opportunity. We're going to be talking with Gary Sick later in the program, and he met with President Rouhani of Iran last Wednesday. But in general, what's your impression of this possible opening? Because there are enormous strategic implications if we pivot towards Iran away from Saudi Arabia.
Well, Gary is a tremendous asset, so I'm glad he's going to be on the show. I think that there are ways in which the interests of the Saudis and the interests of a reformed and normalized Iran can coexist. you know, there's certainly flames down at the base of that relationship that are going to take a long time to heal and work out. But the Saudis have always been, when Prince Turki Al-Faisal was ambassador here, he always wanted an engagement strategy with the Iranians. He didn't want an appeasement strategy, and certainly they had concerns, but the notion that Saudi Arabia was chomping at the bit for a bombing raid of Iran was not true. I think that what we saw play out this last week in New York with Rouhani and his foreign minister, Javad Zarif, is an extraordinary posture that I think gives us a moment. It would be a great tragedy not to test this potential new course with all the might and creativity that we have. You know, there was an op-ed today by Lindsey Graham and Robert Menendez saying they're not fooled by this Iranian effort to seduce us, that the Iranians are still basically bad. and we can, you know, you could invest. There are a lot of vested interests in maintaining these kind of cold wars with nations for a long time, but it's detrimental to Iran. It's detrimental to the region. It drives up defense spending to absurd levels that undermine the U.S. economy. That if we have leadership inside Iran right now, you know, he went back and had, you know, fruit and shoes thrown at him inside Iran. He's taking a real risk, and people on this side need to take a risk to see whether there is a way to do a deal that would give Iran what it wants, which is peaceful use, reprocessing capacity, and that we get what we want, which is, you know, the law of the land in Iran, allow weapons inspectors to make sure that none of this is weaponized. And that, you know, they'll want other things, we'll want other things, but this is an extraordinarily important opportunity on the level of what the end of the Cold War was or the opening to China. It could be that significant geostrategically.
But isn't there a double standard here, Steve Clements, where we demonize Iran? And I was just watching CNN this morning preparing for the program, and there were guests on talking about Iran being the Iranians being crazy, irrational, dangerous. We don't say that about the Saudi Arabians, even though they are the inspiration for Al-Qaeda sprung out of Saudi Arabia. The Taliban, it was funded and largely created by them. Pakistan has been destabilized. The entire Islamic, the Muslim faith has been radicalized through the Wahhabi sect, which is funded by endless petrodollars and spreads around the world. Al-Shabaab are funded by the Wahhabis, and they're blowing up the Sufi mosques as they do in Pakistan. And now you've got Boko Haram, which means, you know, against Western education. They just murdered a bunch of students sleeping in their dormitories in Nigeria. I mean, it seems to me that we turn a blind eye to Saudi Arabia's duplicity, at the same time attribute all kinds of irrationality and danger to the Iranians.
Yeah, I think that is a reasonable, you know, position to take. That there is a you know, certainly not a consistent position across all of this, with the exception that one of the problems you have throughout the Arab world, and maybe less true in Iran, but I wouldn't want to go too far in that, because you've got very powerful people like Rafsanjani and others, and other folks that have become quite wealthy within the IRGC in Iran, who can operate almost as their own franchises. You have Saudis that are ultra wealthy, who can fly their own planes, manage their own networks, fund their own militias, quite independently of what the Saudi government is doing. And I think sometimes it's complex, particularly when you look at this Wahhabist funding network that comes out of individuals as much as any of the king doling out money to these networks. And so you can have a kind of long-term, reliable partnership with the Saudi government, and they have been reliable in many ways in many of the things that the U.S. foreign policy wanted to do. But at the same time, you've got others that are undermining the stability, undermining the region, and doing, you know, various nefarious things.
Right.
Our,
I forgot to mention,
is that
Syria.
The Iranian government, we've not had a consistent relationship. Right. And what Rouhani is doing is offering the prospect of that. And I think it's a vital opportunity that we need to try to take advantage of.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that my list of Saudi Arabia, I forgot to mention the funding the radical or arming the radical factions in Syria as well, which plays right into Assad's hands.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that is, you know, that is part of it, but you know, we find, you know, it's one of that's where the elements of realpolitik come in, with the Saudis and the Americans work well together on a lot of fronts, but they're not going to be entirely consistent on this. The Saudis, for instance, were very, very upset with Obama for his stance on Mubarak and the Muslim Brotherhood coming in. So you can have different different strains, but fundamentally have a dynamic with the government as opposed to the rich, high net worth individuals, you know, who go off on their crusades in the government. But, you know, I would basically say if we were looking at us, you know, look at the Koch brothers, look at the Tea Party. I mean, we have a lot we need to be careful of in terms of taking some of this too far, some of what the neoconservatives have funded inside some of these other governments. So,
like the MEC, right. Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Steve Clemons.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Steve Clemons, who is the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation, and served as executive director of the Japan-American Society of Southern California, and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Center. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with the founder and editor of the Somalia Report, against whom the so-called White Widow the Kenyan authorities have implicated in the Maul massacre. Samantha Luthwaite issued a fatwa before her Twitter went silent on September the 20th.